checking out Real Talk Personal Finance. Shit's about to get real. Cash Flow King with you today. And today, in episode 24, Passive Real Estate Investing Miniseries, Syndications and Funds. Thanks so much for tuning into the show, and special shout out to our brand new listeners in India. India is now on the map. We have new listenership there, so we've added another country to those listening to the show. We certainly appreciate you guys out there, and thank you to all of our listeners that are hopefully continuing to enjoy the show as our listenership numbers continue to increase week over week. If you haven't already done so and you feel like we've earned it, please consider leaving a 5-star rating or review for the show. We would certainly appreciate that. Also, feel free to share it with your friends, family members, coworkers, and so on. Hopefully you're enjoying the mini-series on passive real estate investing. We did another mini-series not too long ago on annuities, and we are certainly open to potentially doing another mini-series on a different topic of your choosing. So again, feel free to email the show. You can also send in any real estate related Q&A that you might have, any questions, specifically as it relates to today's show, the past couple of shows on real estate, or even the next show we're going to do next recording with O-Dog, who will be coming on specifically to talk about multifamily real estate syndication. So that'll be a good one. Feel free to send those questions in and we'll do our best to get back with you. All right, so let's jump into today's episode on syndications and funds and start with what's a syndication. So when we think about real estate syndications, I like to use the analogy of an airplane example. And I know with COVID, it may have been a while since you've been on an airplane, or perhaps you've already started flying again. But whatever the case might be, think back to the last time that you were on a plane. And chances are you were on that plane for a very specific reason. Maybe you were going on vacation. Maybe you were going to visit a friend, a family member. Maybe somebody passed away or got really sick and you needed to fly back home or wherever to see that individual or those individuals. Whatever the reason was, chances are you were on a plane for a very specific reason. And think about everybody else on that plane. Everybody else on that plane, if there was a connecting flight, okay, you make a connection, but everybody else on that plane, assuming that that plane is on its way to its final destination, is there for a reason, and they have a common goal in that particular case to get to a certain location at a certain time for whatever it is that they might need to do once they get there. So when we think about real estate syndication, we can draw a lot of parallels between being on an airplane and how that whole thing is structured versus how a real estate syndication might be structured. So for example, most people on that plane, if not all of them, could not afford to go out and buy their own plane. And even if they could, it's probably not going to be the best use of their funds. So what do they do? Hey, I need to go from location A to location B on this date at this time for whatever my personal reasons are. I'm going to go ahead and buy a ticket on this commercial aircraft along with whoever else wants to go out and buy a ticket because they're trying to go to the same place on the same date at the same time as I am, for whatever reasons that they might have. So everybody buys a ticket, right? Everybody's on that plane because they have a common goal. Everybody on that plane gives control to the pilot. If that plane goes down and it's gonna crash, you really can't get out. You're going down with it, whether you like it or not, boom, it is what it is. But hopefully it arrives safely and everybody on the plane gets to their destination. Now, maybe you have booked your ticket and purchased a ticket with a friend, with a family member, with somebody else that you know, or perhaps you're traveling solo and you don't know anybody else on the plane, but it doesn't matter, your goals are the same. So when you think about it from that standpoint, it's kind of sort of the same thing with real estate syndication. Everyone is going to have a common goal, whatever that might be for them. Everybody's going to go ahead and pool their money together. And essentially, they're going to give up control to the quote unquote pilot, whoever it is that's operating that deal, to carry out the business plan, execute the business plan, and help them hopefully meet their goals. And so when you think about flying on a commercial aircraft with strangers and putting your money together in order to be able to utilize that aircraft to get to where you need to go, the same could be said for most types of real estate syndication investments. That's how I like to think about it. So if you think about a real estate syndication, you are basically pooling your money with other people that have a common goal. You're giving control over to someone else to execute a business plan and hopefully get you closer to whatever goal you may have. That's essentially what we're talking about. And so there's a lot of different definitions. And by the way, I've said this on other shows, today's episode is meant to be a broad and general overview. It's designed to be comprehensive in nature, but it is not necessarily exhaustive, which means in English, we're gonna cover a lot of shit. But at the same time, there's probably more shit that we're not going to cover that you need to research on your own, right? So this is just to get you started. And while we're talking about that, let me get our disclaimer out of the way real quick. We don't give any advice on the show. We do not give any tax, legal, financial, any other advice on the show, except if you listen to the last week's episode and you're going to buy a turnkey rental, our advice was get a home inspection. But other than that, we don't give any other advice on the show. Well, actually, I'll say one more thing. If you're ever going to your local Costco, even though the price has gone up in most locations, do yourself a favor if you haven't already and get yourself a chicken bake. All right. So we've given two pieces of advice on the show. Get a home inspection, eat a chicken bake. Other than that, we do not give any advice on the show. So please realize that this is for entertainment and education purposes only. If you don't like my jokes, don't worry. I have not quit my day job. So we're doing this just for fun, for shits and grins. Okay. So that's the deal. Now, there's going to be several definitions that we'll go through, and there's going to be different concepts we'll talk about. We'll get into some numbers. But again, always do your own due diligence, always do your own research, and always continue educating yourself beyond just this show. Hopefully this show gives you ideas, information, things that you want to further research to go out and, you know, take a look at those things on your own time. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here. Make people aware, give you some good shit, but hopefully you go out and continue to do your research. So when we talk about syndicators, there's going to be different names for syndicators, right? You might hear exactly the word as it says, syndicators. You might hear the word operators. You might hear the word sponsors. And for the most part, most of these words can probably be used somewhat interchangeably. It's not to say there aren't going to be tiny little nuances between the definitions, but you might hear one person refer to somebody as a syndicator. Somebody else refers to them as the operator. Somebody else refers to them as a sponsor. And there can be some slight differences among those definitions there. But for the most part, we're essentially talking about somebody, whether it's a company, hopefully it's a company and not just one individual, that is pretty much carrying out the business plan on that particular deal. And we'll talk a little bit more about here in a second, different types of companies that exist out there and what their role might be as it relates to you as the individual investor. So these terms are often used interchangeably. And when I think about the different types of operations that are out there, it's in some ways somewhat similar to turnkey companies. We talked about turnkey rentals on the last episode, and we talked about different types of providers and different types of operators and different types of organizations and how they function. And there's some parallels between that and what we're going to talk about right now on the syndication side. So there are some groups out there that are vertically integrated, meaning that everything is in-house. I think I used the phrase fully integrated on the turnkey episode that we did last time, and I think what I meant to say was vertically integrated, but I think you understand the concept. But what we're talking about is an organization where everything from top to bottom is done in-house. So the acquisition is done in-house. The rehabilitation is done in-house. The property management is done in-house. The investor reporting and the dashboards and all that sort of thing is done in-house, right? Business development, all that stuff is done under one roof, essentially, or under one parent company, and they likely have several different offices and different subdivisions, but it's all part of one group. And there's one company in particular, and I'm going to try not to name names during today's episode, because again, I don't normally like to promote specific organizations or companies on the show for several different reasons, but there is one group that I work with and that I invest with where they come to mind as a vertically integrated provider, right? Essentially, they have teams that are dedicated to different functions. They have an investor relations team and a business development team and an acquisitions team and a construction team and a property management team and so on and so forth. Everything is done under one roof, essentially, right? And they're a fairly large and growing operation. They're not super huge, but they're kind of one of the up-and-comers that have done very well in making sure to continue to keep those items in-house. And part of the way that they do their deals and where they're buying assets, and I'm probably getting a little long-winded here, but they do so in such a way where it's strategic, where they already have locations and teams and, you know, boots on the ground and teams in place to be able to continue to expand at a reasonable rate and do so and leverage their economies of scale based on the other assets that they already have, which is kind of a nice thing. They would be an example of a fully integrated syndicator. All right. Next would be what I would consider to be sort of a partially integrated syndicator. And this might be, and there's a group I work with that kind of falls into this category, where they kind of sort of do most things in-house, but one big thing that they outsource is property management. So especially if you're talking about multifamily, this is very, very common. If you're talking about some other asset classes within real estate like self-storage, this can be common in some cases. In other companies, they do it themselves, but they will outsource property management. And there's a lot of large companies out there that might specialize in working with certain types of properties and certain types of asset classes where they're doing everything in-house. Maybe they're the ones that are finding the deal. They're doing the acquisition. They're negotiating. They're raising the money. They're doing the investor relations. They're doing all that. They're going to do the value add or manage their subcontractors. But as far as the property management goes, it's not the actual syndicator that is managing the property. They've turned that over. And that's very similar, like we talked about in the last episode about turnkey rentals, where you might have a turnkey operator that outsources to third-party property management. In this example, in this week's episode on syndications and funds, we're talking about a potential syndicator who might be turning the property management function over to third-party property management. And that syndicator might be raising money for and essentially turning around a very large apartment complex, or it could be a storage facility or multiple storage facilities. And we'll talk more about that as the episode goes on. So those are both fine. The next one kind of falls into two different subcategories. And we talked about this again. I keep referring back to it, but there's a lot of similarities on the turnkey show. These would be promoters. And just like I talked about on turnkey, there's promoters that add absolutely no value other than maybe bringing the deal to the table to their investors, which you could argue is some value, but other than that, not very much. And then there's other promoters that have significant value add in terms of how they function. Maybe those are people that actually go to these different providers, they vet the different providers, they tour their operations, all the shit that we kind of talked about that you might want to consider doing as an individual investor on the turnkey episode. There's companies out there as it relates to these syndication deals where they might go specifically out and meet with different syndicators and different operators to see how they're running their businesses and kind of report back to you as the end investor. And you might choose to go with a promoter like this that essentially links you up with the end syndicator or the end operator or the end sponsor that's doing the deal. But there's an extra layer of due diligence in there that you might find comforting. You may not be dealing directly with the syndicator themselves. And just like anything in life, there's pros and cons to that. In a lot of cases, if you're going to have that extra layer in the form of a promoter, then there's typically going to be an extra layer of fees associated with that. And if you feel like they're truly adding value in what they're doing, and there's a group that I relatively recently started investing with that does exactly this, but they're very transparent about their criteria and what they're doing. They're actually going out, they're spending time on multiple occasions with these different syndicators, with these different operators, and vetting them, as opposed to another group who, unfortunately, at the moment, I'm still investing with, but once those deals are closed out, I don't plan on continuing to invest with them. There's other groups out there that really don't do that. They might get on the phone. They might hop on a webinar. They might kind of go out to their network and try to, you know, find out who's raising money for different deals. And because they have a group of investors, kind of just try to get their investors a piece of the action. And again, you could argue that that's providing some sort of value, but at the end of the day, they're not really doing quote unquote due diligence, even though that they say that they are. In my opinion, that's not necessarily the same thing as the first group that I talked about. So there's some promoters that add value, others that don't. And it's up to you in terms of whether or not you feel like it makes sense to work with either of those. In some cases, your answer might be yes. In other cases, your answer might be no. But the other thing I want to mention, and again, being fairly new, as I mentioned in the turnkey episode, I've been investing in real estate now for maybe about a half a dozen years or so. So I would consider myself to still be relatively new on the real estate investing front. You want to be careful of, and this actually happened to me, sponsors or syndicators that might start out as a vertically integrated company and then morph into more of a promoter role. And this actually happened. So my first couple of deals that I did, and we'll talk more about deal structure and deal types and return metrics. We got a lot of stuff to cover today, right? But the first couple of deals that I did were fairly small, and these particular operators were the ones that were doing all the work. They were finding the distressed sellers. They were negotiating on those properties. They were doing and structuring all the value add. They had their own sister company that was doing essentially in-house property management. They were doing it all, but they were doing it on such a small scale. I think the first deal I ever put money in, and it wasn't, in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't a lot of money, but think they were, it was 50 units. And then there was another deal I did that was either 80 or 85 units. And those are very small relative to some of the deals out there today. Now, a lot of times if you're doing a deal, you're well into the hundreds of different units, depending on the deal structure and the specific deal that you're looking at, if you're looking at a specific deal. But they were able to do this because those deals were small enough. And they found out fairly quickly, as did I, that maybe the economies of scale for 50 to 85 units weren't quite what they needed to be versus if you had 100, 200, 300, 400 units, right? If you had a 300 unit apartment complex, it's very different than a 50 unit apartment complex, right? As far as economies of scale and all that good stuff and how the numbers would work. So they got out of those fairly quickly. Luckily, no money was lost. I made a decent return on one and basically got my money back plus a little bit on the other one. But luckily, no money was lost. But what that particular group did, and they didn't exactly come out and announce this, like, hey guys, we're going from, you know, getting our hands dirty and doing all the work to, hey, we're going to be promoters now and essentially pass you along. But that's essentially what they ended up doing. And they kind of transitioned into more of a promoter structure where now they're helping to raise money for other syndicators that are actually doing the deals. And I think a lot of their investors, especially those that are new, and I was one of them, I know better now, but at the time, not so much, where you continue to invest with them only to realize that all they're doing is raising money for somebody else's deal. And again, if they're a promoter and they add value other than just bringing the deal to you, then maybe that's fine. But if they're not really adding value and they're not doing the due diligence that you might expect them to, then maybe that's not the structure that you want to continue to invest in. And for me personally, as far as that goes with this particular group, I'm in a few deals with them still. And once those close out, I more than likely will not be continuing with that group. So I say all that and I tell that story just to kind of caution everybody that even somebody like myself, who is a licensed and credentialed financial advisor, I'm not in the real estate space, right? I'm more of a stock market type of guy, but everybody has to start somewhere. And even somebody that is credentialed and licensed like myself really didn't fully understand this when I was first getting started with certain types of passive real estate investments. So I say that to caution you and anybody that's listening that you might really want to take a hard look at what you're getting into before you actually do it. And I thought that I had researched everything and I thought I fully understood what was going on. And then as time went on and I got more and more sharp around this stuff and started looking at more and more deals and more providers and more operators, I came to realize really what was going on. And I said, wow, I don't think that's the direction that I want to continue to go in. And I started putting money with other people. But anyway, that can easily happen. So let's move on here. So most large apartments that you see as you just drive around your local area, your neighborhood, right, your city, your state, wherever you might be, are probably owned by, could be a very large public REIT or something like that. But more than likely, if it's within a certain number of units, if it's a couple hundred units, right, 100 units, 200 units, 300 units, nothing super massive but big enough, chances are it's owned by a syndication or some sort of private equity group. So a lot of times, I know I used to think way back in the day, you drive by an apartment complex and be like, man, I wish I was the guy or the gal that owned that, because that's a lot of cash flow, right, every month. And chances are it's probably not one individual or one family that owns it. It could be in some cases, there could be some mom and pops out there, but a lot of times, a lot of these buildings are going to be owned by syndications. So a lot of times, if you're wanting to get into some sort of syndication deal, and there's different types of syndications out there, right? So the title of the show is Syndications and Funds, and we'll talk briefly about funds at the end. But as far as syndications, we are typically referring to a very specific asset. So there is a 250-unit apartment complex on 123 Main Street in Phoenix, Arizona, that this particular syndicator is raising money for. And here's the business plan for that. They've done a market analysis study and they understand that the rents are going to be under market by X number of dollars per month on average. And here's the mix of units. Here's how many three bedroom and two bedroom and so on that they have. And here's what other apartment complexes in the surrounding area are renting for. And here are their conditions in terms of when they were built and the style of apartments that they are and the amenities that they have and all these sorts of things. And we're going to raise money. We're going to take down this complex and we're going to do some sort of a value add strategy in most cases, right? They're going to go in and they're going to fix up the units. They might add some amenities. They might replace, you know, the kitchens. They might put granite in the kitchen and stainless steel appliances, and they're going to repaint in some cases, and they're going to do all these different things to improve the units, which ultimately is going to allow them to raise the rents. And because in commercial real estate, the way that these buildings are valued as a function of their net operating income, which we're not going to get super far in the weeds, but pretty much how much money this thing makes after expenses, right? The more profitable it is, the more that it's worth. So if you can take it down at a reasonable price, do some shit to improve it, raise the rents, reduce expenses, thereby making it more profitable, it becomes worth that much more. And then most of these syndicators want to go ahead, get in and get out, make a return for their investors and move on to the next thing. Not all syndications are going to be like that, but that's probably one of the most common that you're going to see. It's a specific asset. It is value add, and that's an example of what they might be looking to do. And that is what they're going to be raising money for. And they should provide you with a breakdown of exactly what the money is going to be used for. There's a ton of documents that you will review. Normally, they're going to give you sort of the highlights or the pitch deck. You might have a one or two page, you know, sort of a sales brochure, if you will, that has some colorful photos and some return metrics, which we'll talk about a little bit later in terms of what you might expect for that particular deal. But then they're also going to have all sorts of other documents, right? They're going to have what's called a PPM, a private placement memorandum, which is probably one of the most important documents that you'll review. They're going to have an operating agreement, which is another important document that you're going to want to review. And they'll have a whole bunch of other supporting documents alongside that so that you can go in and do your due diligence and read the fine print and not just go off the marketing brochure. You hear story after story about investor after investor that simply are investing strictly based on what they see in the glossy pitch deck, right? In the glossy brochure. And that's generally not the way that you want to go about this, right? It's impossible to know everything at some point. And I would argue the most important thing is you got to try to build a relationship with a syndicator and get to know a group that you trust and kind of proceed from there. And initially, you're not really going to have that foundation. So you might ask other people that you know in your circle. You might go off of referrals. You might, however you decide you want to look for these different groups and check them out, that's on you. But I think that's going to be the most important thing. And then secondarily is going to be, okay, what do the financials look like in terms of the underwriting on a particular property? And what is the proposed business plan? And what does that look like? And what are the risk factors? You're going to want to go through all of that. No matter what, just like with pretty much any investment, there's never a guarantee. And you want to be very careful before you jump in, because once you're in, just like on the plane, you're in. And if that thing lands safely and everybody gets to their goal unscathed, great. That's the plan. But if that thing goes down in flames and crashes into the ocean, you're stuck on that plane. Just don't put all your money on that plane, right? And I would be the first of many to probably tell you that if you're going to consider investing in things like this, you want to diversify to the extent possible and not put all your money with one group or in one particular single asset syndication or one particular fund, which we'll talk about at the end, so on and so forth. So just do your own due diligence and make sure that you're paying attention. A lot of times, not always, but oftentimes, depending on how and what regs they're using to raise money for these things, and I'm not going to get into all the differences, but there are different registrations and registration exemptions that are used to raise money for different types of deals, depending on who they're raising money from. Most of the time, investors that invest in these types of deals have to be accredited, depending on how the offering is structured. There are some syndicators out there where you do not have to be accredited. There are very many syndications or syndicators out there where you do need to be accredited. So what the hell does accredited mean, right? Well, an accredited investor, and this definition is subject to change, but at the time of this recording, is an individual that makes at least $200,000 per year or more for the last 2 years with the expectation, a reasonable expectation, to continue to earn at least that much or more in the current year. If that person is married, filing jointly, same definition, but the number jumps up from 200,000 to 300,000. Or, so either one of those can be true, or if your net worth, so your assets minus your liabilities, everything that you own, all your assets, minus everything that you owe, all your liabilities, equals your net worth. And if you exclude your primary residence, if you own a home, take that out of both sides of that equation, if your net worth is at least $1 million or more, you would also be considered to be accredited. There are some other ways to get accredited investor status. Even for those that work in financial services, if you have certain licenses, you can potentially qualify as an accredited investor regardless of whether or not you meet the financial metrics. So that is something else that you may want to look into. If you're not quite accredited based on income or net worth, but you work in financial services or you have certain licenses, there are other ways to obtain accredited status. We're not going to get into all that today in the interest of time, but just know that that is possible. you're going to have to typically prove that you are accredited. And there's different third-party services out there that do this, right? It could be a letter from your accountant or a financial advisor, or you could use a third-party service that will have you upload statements to their portal, and they will verify your status as an accredited investor and report that back to the syndicator. But the syndicator has to go through reasonable steps to make sure that you are, in fact, accredited if it turns out they're raising money for their particular deal or project that requires you to be an accredited investor. Not all of them do. So again, you'll want to check that out with them. But most of the time, you will need to be accredited to put money into these deals. Investment minimums, that's really all over the board. And if you read the fine print, most of the PPMs out there, the private placement memorandums that you're going to read, will basically say that here's our minimum, but we reserve the right to do a lower amount or a lesser amount at our discretion. And so that's something to look out for. I would say most commonly, you're going to be looking at about a $50,000 minimum. So the syndicator is going to want you to put at least $50,000 into the deal. There might be some out there that will go as low as $20,000 or $25,000. That's not as common, but it is somewhat common. You do see that from time to time. There's some syndicators out there that will have a minimum of 100,000. So they might only say, hey, if you can't put in at least 100, we don't want you. So again, going back to building the relationship, if there's a syndicator that you're starting to get to know, maybe you're on their webinars, maybe you've had some phone calls with them, maybe you're interested in a deal with them, but for whatever reason, based on your situation, if they're asking for a $100,000 minimum, but you, let's say, have $100,000 that you're wanting to invest, but you don't want to put it all into one deal, you might be able to talk with them and they might say, hey, you know what, we'll go ahead and we'll lower it. We'll take $50,000 from you and you can put $50,000 in our next project, or you can take the $50,000 and put it with another syndicator. I mean, they're not going to tell you that, but you might decide to do that. So there's different ways to break it up and break it down. I wouldn't get discouraged strictly based off of what they're saying that their minimums are. And for some of them, it's a hard and fast no. Like if they say, hey, our minimum is 20 grand and you call them up and you're like, hey, I got like $1,000, they're going to say, fuck you, right? And they should, because quite frankly, no offense to anybody, but if you got $1,000 to invest, good for you, but you probably shouldn't be looking to get into private placements or syndications or funds or anything like that. You probably need to put that somewhere else to beef up your financial foundation, right? So anyway, there's going to be different minimums out there based on the syndicator and what they're raising money for. And you know, that's up between you and them, how you want to do that. I personally have never negotiated with anybody. I usually, especially if I'm just getting started with a particular group or operation, I will have a tendency to put in towards the minimum. And you can always add, I shouldn't say always, but a lot of times you can add more money later if you need to. And in some cases, if it's a single asset, like, hey, we're raising money for that 123 Main Street, and then they have all the money that they need and that deal closes, well, maybe you can't put more money in that deal. But if they have another deal that comes up, you might be able to put it towards that one. Or once they exit that deal, they're probably going to have another deal in their pipeline that you can maybe essentially move your money into. And you might be able at that point to add a little bit more to your initial investment. A lot of times with the funds, which again, we'll talk about at the end, it's going to be more conducive to you adding money along the way. With these single asset syndications, we've identified this specific apartment complex or this specific whatever that we're going to buy. A lot of times you cannot increase your investment if they've already closed funding. So again, do your due diligence, read the PPM, talk to the syndicators and whatnot, and you'll be able to figure that out as time goes on. So different types of deals. There's three that kind of come to mind, one of which I think is way more common than the other two. And there could be more than this. Again, this is meant to be comprehensive, not exhaustive. But the way that I see it, there's essentially three different types of deals. So you might have sort of a ground up development. This type of real estate syndication, maybe it's, again, as the name says, it's a ground up development. They got to break ground. They have to do a bunch of construction. They got to build whatever it is. It could be a hotel. It could be some apartments. It could be whatever the case is. Well, there's really probably going to be no cash flow at all, if anything, in the beginning phases, right? This is not necessarily a cash flow play, but if things go according to plan, they can make a significant amount of money on the back end. And that's where most of your gains will likely come from in a deal like that. And so if you don't need cash flow now and you're simply trying to grow your capital and you want to, again, have a more growth-oriented investment and you want the money later, well, you might consider a deal like this. At the same time, for a couple reasons, I would argue one, because there's no cash flow, but number two, just based on the risk profile, you're building something from scratch, it's inherently going to be more risky than some of these other types of projects that you might get involved with. So again, your risk tolerance should reflect that. right? If you are a very, 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 very conservative investor and you're putting money into real estate because you want safety and you want stability and all those sorts of things, real estate can sort of provide that for you. But a ground-up development is probably not the right project to put that money into because that specific project doesn't seem to align with your risk tolerance in that example, right? The next one, far more common, we mentioned this earlier on in the show, would be some sort of a value-add deal, right? You might have some lean cash flow, maybe very little cash flow early on, better cash flow once it gets stabilized, and then potentially some larger back-end profit, right? So this was the example of, hey, we're going to buy an underperforming apartment building. Maybe they have some delinquencies. Maybe the units are just outdated. Maybe it's a mom and pop that's trying to manage it and they're doing a very shitty job and we want to take it over and renovate the units and raise the rents and all those sorts of things. Well, in the beginning, when they're kicking all the jackasses out that aren't paying and they're turning units over and renovating and there's nobody in there paying rent at the moment, cash flow might suffer a little bit. But once they get them renovated and they get them re-rented at the higher rate, as they're continuing to ripple and work their way through, all of a sudden now cash flow might tick up a little bit. You got people in there that are paying. You have people that are paying a little bit more. At the same time, you're reducing expenses. Therefore, your NOI is going to go up. Your cash flow inherently will also go up. And then eventually, when the whole thing is done, they can turn around and basically flip it and sell it to another investor. They can sell it to a REIT. They can pretty much exit and hopefully make a large profit on the back end. That's how most of these syndications work. Generally speaking, and we'll go through a couple examples at the end, but generally speaking, most of these operations are wanting to get in and out within usually 3 to 5 years, sometimes a little bit longer, sometimes a little bit shorter, but these are not necessarily going to be a buy and hold forever thing. And there's some that will hold or have a targeted hold that's a little bit longer, but most of the time they want to get in and get out and get investors their money back and then some and move on to the next deal. That's how most of these work, right? The last one is fully stabilized. And I'm in one fund where this is kind of sort of what they go after, which is decent cash flow from the start, but it's not great, right? There's not a ton of potential upside, although if markets do what they generally do, it is possible for you to find an end buyer on the back end that's going to pay hopefully more than you got into it for, but there's no significant value add, so you're not able to really force appreciation as much. There's no ground up development, so you're not taking a piece of dirt and converting it into something that's way more than that, that actually has utility. You're simply saying, hey, this is a really nice apartment complex. We're going to pay a fair price. It's pretty stabilized. We might do a couple little things, but we're pretty much going to hold it for cash flow, let the market do what it does, and hopefully eventually down the road, sell it for a little bit more than we paid for it, right? That would be sort of a fully stabilized type of deal. You don't see as many of those because most investors, that really doesn't excite them. I have a very, very, very small amount of money in this particular fund that goes after these types of properties, but it was something that was a little bit unique and different. And, you know, just as I was getting started and trying to spread my assets and diversify a little bit, I decided to put a small piece of change into one of these things. And, you know, it's very predictable. I get the exact same distribution in this particular case for this fund as every single month. And eventually on the back end, you know, hopefully we're going to sell that at a decent gain and I'll be able to get my money back and then some. So that's kind of, you know, another type of deal. But most of them, as I said, are going to be value add deals that you're looking at. Sometimes you might have a ground up. Sometimes you might have a fully stabilized. Most of the time you're going to have value add. So you need to decide, with all that said, what you're looking for as an investor, right? And so we went over the example. I have it in my notes here about forcing the appreciation and giving an example of value add. We pretty much already talked about that. So I'm going to skip over that right now in this section. One other comment that I do want to make that's kind of similar to the intro episode when I talked about active versus passive real estate investing. I made a comment about if somebody is doing an active form of real estate investing and they're flipping houses, for example, that they're going from cash to an asset, right? The house, and then they're rehabbing it, and then they're selling it, hopefully for a profit, back to cash. So you own the asset for a fairly short period of time, very short period of time. And there's a lot of tax implications, negative ones, that go along with that. However, on the syndication side, you can make a similar argument that you're going from cash to asset to cash, which technically you are, but you're doing it over a slightly longer period of time, and you're doing it in such a way that there's a lot of additional tax benefits that you're going to receive from that syndication over time that probably beyond the scope of today's episode, maybe we'll get into a little bit with ODOG, but you are going to benefit from certain tax advantages of owning the real estate for a slightly longer period of time, even though you're going to end up in cash. And a lot of times what a lot of investors are doing, and I do myself, as far as the syndication stuff goes, is you're going to constantly be buying into new syndications. So just because one exits, maybe hopefully there's a profit that you would think you otherwise would have to pay taxes on that, you've also invested in one or two or three or however many new syndications that, because of the way the tax code works and pass-through losses, you're going to get a K-1 as opposed to a 1099 on a lot of these syndications, pretty much all of them, which is going to be, you know, for a partnership return, you're going to get the pass-through benefits of owning the real estate that can help to offset a lot of those gains. Talk to your tax advisor. We don't give tax advice on the show, but there are some real tangible benefits to doing that. And so most investors are continuing to continuously reinvest the cash proceeds once these deals exit into new syndication opportunities. So you're always going to own something. But you might be asking yourself, well, what the hell do I actually own if I get involved in and buy into a syndication? That's a great question. Most of the time, you're going to own shares of an LLC, a limited liability company, or could be a limited partnership or some other type of pass-through structure. Most of the time, it's an LLC. So you are going to be buying shares in this company, in this limited liability company, and that limited liability company, once all the money is raised, is then going to turn around and actually purchase the specific asset. So you own shares of the LLC, and the LLC is the entity that owns the property in most cases. In case you were wondering about that, that's just a little side note on that. All right. So if you're interested in getting involved in syndications, like I said, do your own due diligence, connect with syndicators, sponsors, operators, know the differences of the different types of companies and how they operate, ask them some difficult questions, ask them about the deal that has gone wrong, ask them if you can talk to other investors, see if they have, everyone's going to have a testimonial, but see if they'll give you, you know, some investors that are actually willing to talk to you. And it's not just the blurb they put on their homepage about how great they are, but they can also tell you about the time that they missed a distribution or their returns weren't as expected. Maybe they've done 10 deals with them and an overwhelming number of them have gone really, really well. Maybe there's one or two that didn't go so hot, right? So you want to know that information. But this is a way for you to pool your money with other investors to get involved in a deal that's probably bigger than you would be able to take down on your own. I personally cannot go out and buy a 300-unit apartment complex, but I can pool my money with other investors that have the common goal of a little bit of cash flow with some back-end appreciation for a nice gain, that want some tax benefits along the way and want to passively invest in real estate. We can essentially pool our money together, even though we don't know each other. We do that through the sponsor or the syndicator. They go ahead and run the deal and execute the business plan and do all the work, and then we benefit from the returns. Syndicator gets their piece, we get our piece. We'll talk about some numbers here coming up, and hopefully everybody's happy and it works well, okay? But when I personally invest in stuff like this, I think of it as, at any given time, when I write that check or when I wire that money, I may never see it again. It's just like with any other type of investment, right? But if the deal completely blows up, you may never see the money again. So you never want to get into numbers that are so big, or you're putting such a large percentage of your investable assets into something where if it goes to zero, you're, again, up Schitt's Creek without a paddle, to use the saying that I used, I think, on the last show, right? You never want to be in that spot. Because sometimes, and I've kind of convinced myself that at some point in time, one of these deals is not coming back. One of these deals is going to go bad, right? And my investment is going to go to zero. $50,000, for example, might turn into zero. And I have to be okay with that. And therefore, you want to spread your assets and diversify to the extent that you feel is reasonable for you in your situation if you decide to do something like this. All right, let's talk about what you're typically going to see, quote unquote, advertised with the sizzle, right? In the brochure or the one or two page flyer that, you know, you might see for some of these syndicators, there's usually going to be three primary return metrics. And we're going to talk about what those are. And then I'm going to get into a little bit about the deal structure. We'll talk way more about that, I think, next week with ODOG about waterfalls and shit. We'll kind of go through that. It'll be pretty cool. We'll talk about syndications versus funds. We'll talk a little bit about funds at the end. And then I'll give you some example numbers to some of the deals that I've seen and some of the deals that I'm in terms of what they're advertising as far as the sizzle goes, right? And again, this is not an invitation to anybody to do anything. We are not raising money. We are not syndicators. We are not looking for funds. If you email the show trying to send us money, I'm going to tell you, go find somebody else, because that's not what we do. Again, this is for education and entertainment purposes only, okay? So three primary return metrics. The first one, and you might see this abbreviated different ways, but it's a cash on cash return. So you might see COC for cash on cash. You might see CCR for cash on cash return. Either way, it's basically the money that you've received divided by the remaining amount of money that you have in the investment. And there's no magic number on this. Again, if you're doing a ground up development project, it could be zero, right? Forever or for the foreseeable future. If you're doing a value add deal that has some cash flow or a stabilized deal, those numbers are going to be different. But in general, I would say somewhere in the ballpark of 5 to 10% is usually common. In today's environment, I would say it's probably going to be closer to a 5 to 7, maybe a 5 to 8%, something like that as far as a cash yield. This reflects the income that you're receiving from the operations, right? This cash on cash return does not include proceeds from the sale, or if they do a refinance, proceeds from the refinance. We'll talk about that in the next return metric. But it's funny, the timing of this. One of the companies that I deal with, again, I won't name them, but I actually got an email from them, I think it was like 2 days ago, as I'm getting my notes and stuff ready for the show. And one of the things that they sent out was for one of the deals that I'm in with them. And they literally just emailed, because they did a partial cash out refinance, right? So they're planning on doing, it's kind of a long story, but they're doing more than one cash out refinance for this particular property. They're doing it in different phases. So you put your money in, right? We'll talk a little bit about deal structure here coming up. And then if they do a cash out refinance and return some of your money back to you, well, that's great, right? But that is not considered, or should not be considered, a cash on cash return. That is a return of capital. But in their case, they're including it in the cash on cash return calculation. And they had a few different percentages and metrics on that email, as if they were doing the world a favor. And they put on there, on one of my deals, that we have a 40.55% CCR, 40.55% cash on cash return. However, their figure includes the partial cash out refinance. So even though it's cash that I received from that partial cash out refinance, it is a return of capital for my initial investment. It is not cash flow from operations, and therefore should not be considered part of the cash on cash return. But apparently they don't know any better. So anyway, like I said, once you get involved with this, another reason not to put a whole bunch of money with one particular company, but you'll start seeing how the different reporting works, how their emails work, how they're calculating certain things and all of that good stuff. And they're, I think, not doing it to be malicious, but unintentionally artificially inflating what the numbers really are in this particular instance. So anyway, the cash on cash return, dollars received in terms of cash flow from operations divided by the remaining amount in the investment. Now, what they could have done is when they run the calculation, account for the fact that not all my money that I initially gave them is still in the deal, because they did a partial cash out refinance and because I got a portion of my money back. They can reduce the denominator, right? They can reduce the remaining amount of dollars that I have in that investment. But the numerator, the number on the top, should still be cash flow from operations. And I can tell you that it's not 40%. But anyway, so the first one's cash on cash return. Number two is the internal rate of return, also known as the IRR, the internal rate of return. This, by most people's standards, is going to be sort of the gold standard of comparing different types of returns. And one of the primary reasons for that is it does reflect the timing of cash flows, right? So as I mentioned, a lot of investors want to essentially, and I was listening to a podcast recently, another timely podcast that happened to come out right around the time that I was getting ready to record this. And there was somebody on there that talked about the race to get the money back, right? Investors are in a race to get their dollars back. Why? Because depending on how things are structured, you can get a portion of your money back and then you can reinvest those dollars into something else. So you might be in deal number one. Perfect example, kind of this deal I'm talking about. You put money into deal number one. They do a partial cash out refinance. You get a portion of your money returned to you, okay? But you still have ownership and you're still earning a return on deal number one. But you can now take those proceeds that you've gotten back, in this case, from that partial cash out refinance, and you can redeploy that into another investment and start earning a return on those dollars in another investment, right? So the internal rate of return, the IRR, reflects the timing of the cash flows, okay? So if you have a project that does really, really well and they're projecting it's going to be 5 years and they do it in two years, well, your IRR is going to be significantly higher than if they took the full 5 years to execute the business plan and provide the projected returns. So that accounts for that, right? The timing of cash flows. When did your money go in? How much did you get back periodically in terms of cash flow? How much did you get back and when did you get it back in terms of a cash out refinance if applicable? And then on the back end, when did you get the sale proceeds back and what were those numbers and when did that happen, right? And it all accounts for the timing of cash flow. So your internal rate of return is probably going to be one of the most accurate by most people's standards and easily comparable return metrics that you're going to see out there. And you'll, like I said, you'll see this on the glossy brochure type of stuff that they send out to you as well. So as far as that goes, numbers are all over the place. I would say that 15 to 25% is common, but again, it can be significantly more. You'll always hear the outliers about, you know, the deal that did a 70 something percent or an 80 something percent IRR. Those deals are kind of home runs or grand slams. You're not necessarily going to see those all the time or every day. I think if you're in the 15 to 20% range is probably going to be reasonable in today's environment. You might see some that promote slightly more than 20%. But if you see somebody that's promoting something like crazy, you know, like a, oh, I don't know, somebody that's like over 30%, for example, IRR, I would be very, very wary of that. Number three and the final one is the equity multiple, right? Another one that's kind of cool and really easy to think about. Right? So an equity multiple is basically the money received divided by the money invested. So if somebody says they have a 2x multiple and you put in 100 grand, by the end of the projected hold, you should have doubled your money when you take into account the cash flows that you received along the way, plus the profit on the back end. So you put in 100, maybe you got a few dollars along the way every quarter, and then a few years later they exited, hopefully they did it profitably, and when it's all said and done and you look at how much you got from cash flow throughout the hold, plus how much profit you got on the back end, in total you doubled your money, right? You had 200 that came back to you ultimately. So that would be an example of an equity multiple. And so 1.5 to 2.5 times your initial investment, that is a common equity multiple, or at least it used to be. These days, you're probably seeing closer to like a 1.7 to 2.0. But again, it depends on the hold period, right? And there's some offerings that may choose to hold or have a targeted hold that's a little bit longer and others that's a little bit shorter. And all that stuff can impact these metrics. That's a little bit on the three primary return metrics. So if I look at, I wrote out some examples here. I took three different examples from single asset syndications, which is what we've been talking about so far during the show. And then I took some examples from a few of the funds, and we'll talk about the funds here in a little bit. But as far as what you're going to see and what they're going to promote to you, I'll give you some examples. So let's go with the single assets. We'll start with example number one. There was one deal that was a 248-unit apartment complex in Florida. I'm actually in this deal. I'm in all these deals. 248 units in Florida. This is from a couple years ago. They projected at the time, which is a stupidly wide range, but anywhere from a 7 to a 30% cash on cash return. I don't think it's ever going to be anywhere near 30%. I think reasonably 7 to low double digits is going to be more appropriate. And then they projected a 3 to 7 year hold. So remember I said 3 to 5 years is fairly common, sometimes a little bit longer. In this case, it was a 3 to 7 year hold and a 26 to 30% internal rate of return, or 26 to 30% IRR. So that's what the sizzle says, but you got to dig into the documents and read about, and again, their business plan and the business risks and, you know, the operating agreement and how the waterfalls and all that stuff is structured, which we'll get into here shortly as far as that goes. But that's what you're going to see sort of on the front page, if you will, to get investors excited. All right. The next one was a 7 to 10% cash on cash return that was projected, a 15 to 16% internal rate of return, and a 3 to 5 year projected hold. And this is for another deal I'm in, which is 160 units in South Carolina. So that one, obviously the numbers are very different. The targeted hold time is shorter. The projected return numbers are a little bit lower, but that was another deal that I did. And then the last example that I put here was a 7 to 10%, again, cash on cash return, a 15 to 17% internal rate of return, a targeted hold of 3 to 7 years. And this particular deal was a 300 unit apartment complex also in Florida. So, and this was from a couple years ago as well. So the numbers are likely to have changed, and they're probably going to be different depending on, again, the specific property, the syndicator, the business plan, what they're using for estimates, assumptions, comparables, the whole nine yards. These numbers can be all over the place, but those are just three quick examples for single assets, right? A 248-unit apartment complex, 160-unit apartment complex, and a 300-unit apartment complex in terms of what those numbers could look like. And when ODOG comes on, I'm not sure if he's going to get into whether or not, you know, any specific metrics in terms of what some of these sponsors that he's working with are projecting or have projected. That's up to him how much information he wants to get into. But I thought it would be cool just to give a few quick examples of what that looks like. Like, okay, what's the sizzle, right? What am I looking at as an investor to get me interested to look further into this deal and do more due diligence on this deal? And those are some of the things that these syndicators are sharing with you. And there's a little bit more, which we'll talk about next. The next thing is deal structure. And like I said, we'll probably spend a fair amount of time talking about this on the next episode, but there's something out there, if you've been around the syndication world, that you'll hear pretty much fairly frequently about preferred returns, oftentimes referred to as the pref. What's the pref? I got a 7% pref or an 8% pref or a 10% pref. Well, what the fuck is a pref? A pref is a preferred return. Well, what does that mean? A preferred return, think of it kind of like the syndicator says to you, okay, you're going to give us some money for this particular deal. That's great. Here's what it looks like. Here's all the documents you need to know to make your decision. Here's the sizzle, right? Here's the cash on cash we're projecting and the internal rate of return we're projecting and the equity multiple we're projecting, yada, yada, yada. But we're going to make sure that you get a preferred return. And oftentimes they'll do this in such a way that you get paid before they get paid. And they want to get paid. And there's a lot of different ways that they get paid. We'll talk about that shortly. But they're going to structure it in such a way that you know you're going to earn a certain yield on that cash no matter what. Now, you may not earn it right away, but by the time the deal is all said and done, if everything goes according to plan, they will make it up to you. So for example, if they say we have a 7% preferred return, also known as a 7% pref, and you put in 100 grand just to keep the numbers round, all right? 7% of $100,000 is $7,000. So you will accrue a $7,000 return, essentially a $7,000 cash flow, if you will, each year. And depending on the deal and what they're trying to do, is it a heavy value add or not? And most of the time, if they have a preferred return, there is going to be a value add component, if not a stabilized component. You typically will not see a preferred return with a ground up development, although you may, it is possible, but you may not, depending on how the deal's structured. But most often you're going to see something like a 7% preferred return on a value add apartment deal. So they're going to say, all right, well, we're going to go in there. We're going to acquire it. We're going to turn the units around. We're going to do this, that, and the other thing and execute our business plan. And you will accrue a 7% or $7,000 annual preferred return if we have enough free cash flow from operations to pay that out to you when we do our distributions. And some syndicators will do a quarterly distribution. Some of them will do a monthly distribution. Most often it's going to be quarterly for administrative purposes, but some of them will do monthly. We're going to pay that out from free cash flow, but in the event we can only, let's say in the beginning, pay a 4% or 3% cash yield, right? Well, you're accruing 7% in the background. So they'll pay what they can, when they can, from that free cash flow, that 3 to 4% during that first year, let's say. But in the meantime, you're accruing 7% total. So if they paid you 4 and you have a 7% pref, then that 3% difference that's accruing in the background will be paid to you at a future date. And so then year two goes around and now they started to renovate some more units. Now things are a little bit more stable than they were initially. Now cash flows are increasing a little bit. And now instead of a 4% yield from in terms of free cash flow from operations, it jumps up to say a 6% yield in terms of free cash flow from operations. Well, now they're gonna go ahead and pay out the 6% free cash flow to you. But remember, you were promised a 7% pref. I say promised in quotes because all this can go to hell in a handbasket and you could get zero. But if everything goes according to plan, you're accumulating at 7%. So they're paying out what they can. In this example, 6% from free cash flow. But that 1% difference is now also accruing in the background. And then year three rolls around. And all of a sudden now, as they continue to stabilize the property, cash flow jumps up to 8%, 9%, something like that. Well, that's above the pref. So they'll still pay out from free cash flow. And now at that point, they're going to start to make up that accrued preferred return that was in the background. They're going to pay what they can from operations, from that free cash flow, and they're going to start to pay down what they owe you. They're going to start to pay down that 7% pref, and so on and so forth. In some cases, the cash flow from operations, it's rare, but in some cases, they can pay that right away, and it's a non-issue, right? A lot of the times, their cash yield is going to be slightly less. Your preferred return, if you have one, is going to be slightly more, and they will need to make it up to you as time goes on. They'll probably start to make it up to you from free cash flow from operations in subsequent years when the property is more stabilized. However, they can also, if they decide to exit, and sell the property at a time when they're going to hopefully do so at a gain, and you've not gotten all your preferred return back yet, a lot of times they will true that up on the sale, right? So they'll say, okay, well, we owed you this much from your accrued preferred return, so we're going to go ahead and pay that to you, and then we're going to move down onto the next thing and figure out how to split the rest of this money, which we'll talk about here in a second. So that's an example of a preferred return. So it is not the same, and I made the mistake of thinking this. When I first got started investing in syndications, I thought it was the same thing as a cash yield. And while it's somewhat similar, it's not exactly the same. And if, you know, the more you do your due diligence and you realize, okay, well, they're not projecting to meet the pref in the first 2 to 3 years. So even though it's accruing, you're not necessarily going to see that money right away. And if things go better than expected and they can pay it out, then chances are they will pay it out. But that's basically how that works. So that's a preferred return. So the way I like to think about it is, hey, if I took 100 grand and put it in the market, right, I might get 7%, 8%, give or take a little bit on average over a long period of time for a fairly aggressive portfolio. Okay, well, what if I can hopefully do better than that with some tax benefits while they pay me cash flow along the way? And if they can't pay me all that in any given year, they're going to make up for it on the back end as long as the project doesn't go belly up. Okay, great. You know, that might be something that you're interested in. So that's, I think, how they entice a lot of investors, because they see 7-8% pref and they're like, well, shit, I'm getting that in my stock market portfolio anyway. That's pretty much the upside. You're telling me you're going to basically accrue that for me along the way and I could potentially double my money in 5 to 7 years and get some tax benefits along the way. Sign me up, right? And again, there's a lot more to it than that, but I think that's part of the pitch on the part of the syndicator to get investors interested in these types of deals. All right. Splits. That's the next thing. All right. So what's the split look like? Sometimes this is also referred to as the waterfall, but a split is basically going to be, think of it kind of like a profit sharing arrangement between you as the passive investor, oftentimes referred to as the limited partner or LP, limited partner. You're putting your money in the deal and you're not doing shit. So your liability is limited and your risk is also limited to the amount of money that you invest in the deal in almost all cases. Check with your attorney, not legal advice. And then you have a portion that goes to the syndicator or the sponsor, right? That is typically the general partner or the GP, general partner. They're the ones doing the work or overseeing the work and outsourcing the work. But they're the ones responsible for executing the business plan, right? You're writing a check and going to play fucking video games, and they're taking your money and either doing something with it or making somebody else do something with it and overseeing the project. That's pretty much how it's going down, okay? Now, you, as the limited partner investor and putting that money in, are typically going to have the lion's share of the profit split, okay? Some syndicators, they make it very easy. They'll say something like, all right, we're going to give you whatever, 7% pref to go off the previous example. So you'll accrue a 7% preferred return. Anything above and beyond that, including at the sale when we typically make most of the money, we're going to split it 70-30, or we're going to split it 80-20, or we're going to split it 65-35. Whatever the numbers are, typically the first number is the larger of the two. That's the number that goes to you. That's the percentage that goes to you, to the limited partner, the LP investor, passive investor. And the other percentage is the percentage that goes to the GP, the general partner that's actually carrying out the business plan. So they might say 7% preferred return and 70-30 split. You get 70%, we get 30%. Thanks for doing business, right? That might be how that goes. And in the three examples that I mentioned on those apartment deals, that's exactly the structure. It is a 7% preferred return and 70% above and beyond that to the limited partner investor, myself, and 30% to the general partner, right? That is how that is going to work. Now, that's to keep it simple. That is a simple split. But some firms like to make it a little more complicated, and they want to get paid for their work if they do a really, really good job, and that's understandable. So in comes what a lot of people talk about as a waterfall, right? Think about it as like a faucet, and you have a pail or a bucket underneath it, right? You're filling up that bucket. You put one big ass bucket directly underneath the middle of the faucet, right? And we fill that up. That happens first. That's typically going to be your preferred return. And then if you keep the water on, eventually once that bucket fills up and the preferred return is paid, now you have water that starts spilling over each side of the bucket and they drop down to the next tier or the next set of buckets in the waterfall. And that's kind of how we think about this. Okay, well, we fill up that bucket first, and then once that overflows, then all of a sudden, we're going to go and do, for example, 70-30 until the investor hits a certain hurdle rate or hits a certain IRR, internal rate of return. And that number is going to vary. They might say, hey, 7% pref, then we'll do a 70-30 split until you make a 15% IRR. And then after that, our 70-30 is going to go down to 60-40. Right? So you insert another couple of buckets underneath that waterfall. Now it's going to flow down and it's going to go 60% to you as a limited partner investor and 40% to the general partner that's running the thing above that 15% IRR that you got as the investor. And we'll do that until you make, let's say, I don't know, a 20% IRR as the limited partner investor. And then once you've done that, if we really knocked it out of the park and there's still profit to be split, well, hell, we want to be paid for that. Anything above and beyond a 20% IRR to you, the limited partner investor, we're going to split it 50-50. So we put another couple buckets down at the bottom of that waterfall, and that starts flowing in 50-50. 50% to you as a limited partner investor that's above and beyond your 20% return, and 50% to the general partner. So there's a lot of either, well, actually, I should say both. There's a lot of syndicators for single asset purchases and repositions that will structure that way. And then there's also some funds, which we'll get into here shortly, that structure in a very similar way. Not all do, some don't. So I guess you could say, beware of the waterfall. Waterfalls aren't necessarily bad. It is an incentive for them to do a good job, I would say, as the general partner. But at the same time, a lot of people see 7% pref 70-30, and they assume that they're gonna get 70% of any and all profits. And while that might be true for certain deals that don't have the waterfall, you want to make sure you understand whether or not your particular deal has a waterfall or not, because you might only get 70% until you hit a hurdle, and then it might drop to 60, and then it might drop to 50, and so on and so forth. But again, you want everybody to be aligned as much as possible. There's always going to be inherent conflicts of interest with these sorts of things, but you want everybody making money pretty much. So, you know, it's not unheard of for those waterfalls to exist. They can be somewhat confusing. There's some really, I don't want to say tricky definitions, but some of these operating agreements and private placement memorandums, they can be fairly wordy. So you want to make sure you're paying particular attention to how they are describing these things as you're reviewing them, because they can change sometimes just one or two words and pretty much change the meaning of the entire thing, right? Same thing, a quick example would be like the preferred return. Most of the time, it's going to be cumulative in non-compounding. And you're like, what the hell did Cash Flow King just say, right? It's cumulative because it's going to accrue and carry over from year to year. But whatever amount at the end of the year that's outstanding that they might owe you from the preferred return that they could not pay you from operating cash flow, from free cash flow, it will accumulate into the next year. It's cumulative, but it's not going to compound. You're not going to get to earn 7% on the amount outstanding that they owe you, unless they tell you that it is a compounding, cumulative and compounding, which is not very common. So changing just little things like that and little words in the operating agreement in terms of the order of distributions and who gets paid and when. Does the investor get their capital back first or not? Does the investor get their capital back and then we do the split? Or do we do the pref and then we split after the pref? And, you know, there's so many different ways they can structure these things. That's why it's really, really important that you do your homework, you do your due diligence, and you read these freaking documents that pretty much nobody reads. And there's a couple of cool ways. Like one thing that I like to do when I'm reading through these, I actually do read them, but sometimes they get pretty long and you might get a little bit fatigued. I'll always go back and look at it a second time, but sometimes I'll do a little search. And I found something one time by doing this that I didn't initially catch initially when I reviewed the document. I did Control F to search the document, right? A little search box pops up and I put in the percentage sign. So anytime there's a fee that's mentioned, a split that's mentioned, anything that has a percentage sign, it's going to take me to that in the document. And I would click next, 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 next. And I would go through and make sure that I saw everywhere that there was a percentage. And there was one particular item for this one particular group who I had done several deals with at that point. And they decided to change something. Most of their documents are fairly standardized at this point. It's just they change, you know, new entity for the new deal. Sometimes they might change the structure slightly. But for the most part, everything was the same. Well, they went from charging, I believe it was a flat dollar fee for some sort of administrative charge, against the deal to a percentage of the money raised for the deal, which to me makes no sense, right? If you have to do something administrative and you have certain costs as far as that goes from an administrative standpoint, then charge whatever dollar fee is commensurate with what that takes. But just because you raised a little bit of extra money, but you did the same amount of work, now all of a sudden you want that fee to be a percentage of the amount of money that you raised. And that was one of the final things with this particular group that, among others, that I just decided to say, you know what, I'm not going to do any future deals with them, because that was pretty slick. You know, that's something that I guarantee you the vast majority of investors that are with them did not realize that they did. And quite frankly, I would have missed it too if I didn't do that little trick and hit Control F and search with the percentage in there just to see. You might do the same thing with a dollar sign, although the percentage is probably going to yield more search results. So however you want to do it, kind of make it dummy proof and just go through more than once and make sure that you're looking at everything and you're not missing anything. Okay, pass-through depreciation we talked about, but that's one of the big things is you are investing passively as a limited partner. You're putting money into the deal, but you get a lot of the same tax benefits that you would otherwise get if you owned the building directly, if you owned the 300 units yourself, which again, you probably don't have enough money or the inclination or the desire to do the legwork to own and operate a complex of that size, but you're getting the same benefits as somebody that owned it directly, which is in a lot of ways very different than a REIT, a real estate investment trust. For those that are in the stock market, there's nothing necessarily wrong with REITs. They can, depending on the type of account that you own them in, they can be okay in certain situations, but they typically have a high correlation to the stock market overall. So if markets go down, generally those things are going to go down alongside it, not necessarily a one-to-one correlation, but it's up there. And for those that are investing in syndications and single assets or funds or anything like that with direct ownership, that's not necessarily always going to be the case. In fact, you can make an argument that, and I actually was listening to a recent podcast specifically about this, where they made an argument that the correlation was negative. I think it was like a negative, I want to say it was negative 0.2 or something like that, that the guest on the podcast had mentioned about correlations for syndication investments versus for REITs, which had like a 0.6 or 0.7 positive correlation to the stock market. So it's, again, another way to get involved in assets that are generally non-correlated, and you get the benefits of actual direct ownership of real estate. It can be fairly complex. You're probably going to need a tax advisor, as I mentioned before, that specializes in real estate. I know I pay a mini fortune to mine, but you want somebody that understands this stuff, that works with real estate investors, that can help you out. But depending on your situation, your tax situation, and so forth, this is going to benefit some people more than others. But in general, it should probably benefit the vast majority, if not all people, that are choosing to invest in real estate in this fashion. So you will get a K-1 for typically every syndication that you're in. And that's kind of a bitch come tax time, because like I know even for myself, at this point, we're beginning of August of 2022, my 2021 taxes are still not filed yet. And we're getting ready to do that. But we had to file for an extension. And partly the biggest reason was we were waiting for several K-1s from different syndicators. And so they have a tendency to come a little bit later. If you're one of those that likes to file your taxes on time, all the time, every year, never have to file for an extension, you have everything you need ready to go by, you know, basically end of January, beginning of February, probably not going to happen if you decide to go this route. So just keep in mind that your K-1s will typically come in much later. Sometimes you'll get them in March, sometimes you'll get them at the beginning of April, and you're kind of racing up against the clock, and there's a very high likelihood that you may end up having to file an extension depending on how many syndications that you're in. I don't think that that's a reason in and of itself to choose to invest or not invest, but it is something to keep in mind if you're on the fence and you're like, fuck it, I don't want to have to deal with that. Well, then maybe that's not for you, right? But it is something to be aware of. Next, sponsor fees and splits. Somebody told me one time, I was on an investor little field trip for some real estate stuff, and there was actually a guy there who was just getting started in raising money, of all things, and I don't invest with him, but he mentioned to me, I was talking about this particular group and the different layers of fees that they had and the amount of money that they were making and all this stuff, and he said to me, he said, Cashflow King, said, don't count other people's money. And that stuck with me for years to this day. And what he wasn't trying to be rude, but what he was saying was, listen, if the deal works for you based on your criteria, your risk tolerance, your return preferences and metrics, then do the deal. If it doesn't work for you, don't do the deal. But it doesn't matter how much or how little money that they're making. Don't count other people's money. And I thought that was really, really an interesting comment. And like I said, it stuck with me for several years up until this day, and will probably continue to stick with me for the foreseeable future. But really resonated with me when I stepped back and thought about it. I was a little in shock when he said it to me at first, but then I'm like, you know what? I guess he's right. There are a lot of different layers of fees. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. The people that are raising money, that are doing deals, that are syndicating, most of them, if not all of them, are making money, and they should, right? For most of them, this is a full-time endeavor. They don't have another day job. This is their day job. They're the ones that are working on all aspects of this, whether it's directly doing it themselves or outsourcing it and monitoring it and all that good stuff. So they need to make a living too, but there are multiple types of fees, and we don't have time. This is not an exhaustive list by any means, but there's going to be different types of fees that may or may not apply depending on the type of deal that you're in. I'll list off a few of them. Again, you can read about them in the PPM. You can read about them in all the documents that they might give you as you're exploring whether or not you want to get involved in certain types of syndications if you decide you want to get involved in any syndications out there. But you're going to have things like acquisition fees, asset management fees, property management fees, disposition fees, construction management fees if applicable. You're going to have the splits that we talked about. You might have a waterfall that we talked about. There's a lot of different ways that they get paid. Acquisition fee, that's when they buy the property. They might pay themselves 1.5%, 2%, 3%, something like that up front. Hey, we did a lot of work on the front end. We're going to close on this. We raised a bunch of money. Boom, payday. Let's go. Acquisition fee. Asset management fee. Okay, that's going to be different than the property management fee for the people that are actually managing the property. Asset management fee is going to be for them essentially overseeing the entire project. For them, as far as, you know, they're providing the technology to you typically to use, they're probably licensing that as far as the portals go. They essentially have to, if they're not doing the work themselves, they have to oversee the property management company, make sure that they're doing a good job, monitor the reports that are coming in from that property management company, have certain set calls or visits with that property management company. They're essentially still managing the asset and the syndication, even if they're not necessarily managing the property, like the property management company does at the property level, they're still doing work there. So there's an asset management fee that you might see. The property management fee, again, for the company that's actually managing the property, assuming they're using a third-party property management company. Disposition fee, when they sell it, hopefully at a nice profit. When they exit, boom, another payday. You might see them put in 1%, 2%. Some will use zero, depends, you know, for them to get paid on the sale. Construction management, if they're doing a ground-up development, like I mentioned, or a lot of times in storage, they might take over a storage facility that has some land that's not developed. So it might be partially cash flowing because they have units already that are producing income. But they might be putting an addition on there at the same time. And if they have a construction crew and they have to manage that, there's going to be construction costs. So you might have a construction management fee that might apply in a certain type of deal like that. You're going to have the splits I mentioned, whether that's 80-20, 90-10, 70-30, 60-40, whatever it is, that's going to be in there. You might have the waterfall where after you hit a certain hurdle rate, that split changes. So there's going to be several different layers in there. And as somebody like myself that is somewhat fee conscious, you just need to get used to it. And you, again, need to take the advice of the person that said to me, don't count other people's money. And I've kind of looked at it from the standpoint of, okay, why am I investing in this, right? What is my goal? What am I looking to do? What is the return profile? What is the business plan? How am I going to perform as a passive investor if this goes according to plan? And what's the likelihood that it does so based on a whole number of factors? That's what I need to be focused on. Not, oh my gosh, can you believe they have a 2% fee on this and a 3% fee on that and blah, 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 blah. If the numbers still work for you and it makes sense, then do the deal, right? So finally, we talked almost exclusively the entire episode about deal-specific syndications, like these different apartment complexes, sort of a single asset. Here's the property in South Carolina. Here's the property in Florida. Here's a property in Phoenix, wherever, right? There's also funds out there that are becoming extremely popular these days. And usually anytime something becomes popular, you want to be wary of that, right? And they've been around for a while. But a lot of these funds basically are designed to say, hey, what's a way that we can get some diversification, that our investors can get some diversification? We can raise some money. We know the types of assets we want to invest in. We have an idea of what the return profiles are going to be like. We know what we want to do, and we want to be able to raise the money to go ahead and execute the business plan and acquire multiple assets or multiple properties and put them under one fund. And that way there our investors don't have to decide, hey, I want to put money in this deal, but I'm not so sure about that deal. And I only have so much money left. I don't want to just put it on this next deal because what if the one after that is better, right? So then they have to kind of pick and choose and bob and weave. And they want to kind of eliminate that, right? So a lot of companies have started coming out with different types of funds. And you can choose to invest in more of a fund structure as opposed to a single asset if you want to do that. The major advantage, in my opinion, of a deal-specific syndication would be you know exactly what you're getting up front. 123 Main Street in Phoenix or whatever. I'm making that up. There might be a Main Street in Phoenix. There probably is. I have no clue what the fuck is on Main Street in Phoenix. I just keep using that as an example. But you know exactly what you're getting, right? So you can do a little bit more underwriting before you put your money in to that particular deal. With a fund, you don't necessarily know that, but you do pick up some other benefits, right? It does provide some diversification. And a lot of times, geographic diversification. You might be in one fund that owns properties in several different states. Now, you probably don't want to invest in a fund that's going to own properties in every single state. That wouldn't be, I mean, from a tax preparation standpoint for your tax advisor, that's a fucking nightmare and it's going to cost you a lot of money. But you still might be somewhere in a handful of states, for example. There might be certain tendencies for a lot of these operators to invest in the Midwest and the South and things like that. So, okay, maybe you decide you want to get involved there for some geographic diversification. Also, the number of assets. If you're in a fund, it's going to own multiple assets. It's not just a single asset. So if one does poorly, the other ones hopefully will be doing well, right? Same concept that you're probably used to with your stock market types of investments. So you have some diversification from that standpoint. But you don't necessarily have the ability to underwrite a specific asset before you put your money in. So that would be one of the downsides. You can do that with a deal-specific syndication. You cannot necessarily do that with a fund structure. Be careful about what some people call a double promote. We talked about promoters at the beginning. A lot of times, if they're adding value, it's okay to use them. But you want to keep in mind that if you went directly to a syndicator that's vertically integrated and they do everything and they say, hey, the split is 70-30. And then you go to a fund that might also happen to invest in that particular syndicator's deals and the fund says to you, well, we got an 80-20 split. At first glance, you probably think, well, shit, I want to put money into the fund because I'm going to get 80%. But what you don't realize is you're getting an 80-20 split from the fund. But the fund is still investing with the syndicator if they're not vertically integrated. If they have to go out and find a syndicator to invest with and partner with, they're going to be investing into that syndicator's deal. So if that syndicator was offering 70-30, right, and you're in a fund that offers 80-20, then your 80% from the fund is going to be 80% of the 70% that the syndicator is offering. So 80% times 70% is 56%. So you're actually getting just north of half of the return versus if you had gone with the syndicator directly. Now, just because you're putting money in a fund does not necessarily mean that there's a double promote, right? And so to give you an example, I have three different examples here of some funds that I am currently in. And some of those funds, well, actually, I didn't put the splits on here, but I'm pretty sure I know them. Well, as I go through each metric, I'll know who's who. One of the funds in particular, they are a promoter, okay? And they give an 80-20 split. So they're going to give an 80-20 split. And if they're with a sponsor or syndicator that is giving a 70-30 split or even another 80-20 split, you're going to be getting less. But this particular group, I know, because they're very transparent about it, they go out, they take the trips, they spend time, multiple occasions to meet with and vet. They have a documented process of going through. And a lot of times, the syndicators have to qualify essentially to get into the fund. And it's not a very easy thing to do. And so I'm totally fine with a little bit of extra fee layer there to make sure that the vetting process and the due diligence is very thorough. And so there's one group that I'm with. Again, they do an 80-20 on the fund, but it's going to be 80% of whatever they're getting from the end syndicator, right? And a lot of times, if they're placing money, especially in the form of a fund, they can actually negotiate a better split with the syndicator. So the syndicator might have, okay, they're going to do different, and this is getting really complicated, but different classes of units you can buy. You can buy a Class A1 unit versus a Class A2 unit. And Class A1, your minimum investment might be $50,000. Your Class A2, your minimum investment might be $1,000,000. So Class A1 gets a 70-30 split, and Class A2 gets an 80-20 split, for example. Well, if you're in a fund, and the fund goes and buys Class A2 units with a more favorable 80-20 split, then you're getting 80% from your fund of the 80-20 split from the syndicator, So 80 times 80 is 64%, still a little bit less, but you're getting 64% of the deal versus if you went to the sponsor directly and you bought a Class A1 unit with a 70-30 split, well, now you're getting 70%. And you might say, well, shit, 70% is still better than 64%, but did you really get the extra layer of due diligence? Did you really get the extra things that you might get by going into a fund? Were you able to invest in not just that one sponsor's deal because you only had, say, 50 to 100 grand to begin with to put into the fund, right? Did you get to then invest in 10, 15, 20, however many other projects by being invested in the fund, and you're getting 64% of a bunch of different deals as opposed to 70% of one deal with no due diligence other than your own, hoping that it does well. And there's no right or wrong answer, right? Because I've done both, right? I mean, you can do it however you want to do it, but it is something to be aware of. That's another thing, is be aware of the double promote or the double layer of fees. And just make sure if you are paying that or going to pay that, that you're getting some value for that. And that's a very subjective decision. That's completely up to you as the individual investor, but it is something to be aware of. Okay, different types of funds that are out there. We talked a lot about apartments. We talked a little bit about storage, but there are other types of funds that exist with real estate related investments in general that you might want to think about or be aware of. One of the most basic ones are certain types of note funds, N-O-T-E, note funds, that typically will buy distressed or underperforming real estate notes, right? Underperforming mortgages, for example, that are backed by and collateralized by real assets or real property. And you can invest in a fund that pretty much that's what they do, right? And those can pay all over the board. I've seen them 10%. I've seen them 12%. There's a group out there, they're not doing notes, but something very similar to that where they're paying 15%, which quite frankly, I check them out and they're dog shit. And I mean, there's a reason they're paying 15%. And that's a whole separate story. There's some out there that might only pay 7 or 6 or 8, right? And in today's environment, numbers have come down a little bit. But you can essentially, if you wanted to, look into some type of note fund. Now, you're not going to get a lot of the same tax benefits per se that you might get with some of the multifamily or some of the self-storage or some of the other assets that can be, you know, bonus depreciated and things like that. Again, talk to your tax advisor. But there's a way to get involved there. It's super straightforward if you wanted to. There are certain, we mentioned agricultural on the last turnkey episode, where you can buy individually deeded parcels and you can invest in different types of agricultural real estate that could be managed for you on a turnkey basis. That's all true, but a lot of those operators are now starting to raise money with more of a fund structure. So you may not actually own individually deeded parcels of whatever it is that you're buying, but instead you may invest in a fund and you might own LLC shares of the fund, and the fund itself owns the parcels. It's just a slightly different way that's a little bit more administratively feasible for them to do that and for them to raise money. So you might be able to get into an agricultural syndication if that's of interest to you. There are syndications out there. There's one that's been popular for quite some time where they promote ATMs, automated teller machines, believe it or not. And you can buy into different tranches of ATMs. And it's more of a cash flow play. There's really not a back-end appreciation play. But for those that have a bunch of gains and they need to get some depreciation, and again, talk to your tax people, but there's different funds that are designed to do different things. This one is pretty much a cash flow play with the intention of getting an exorbitant amount of depreciation that can be used because of the nature of the ATM machines and the fact that they can be depreciated very quickly. So that would be another example of a fund. Most of the time though, most of the funds that you're going to see are going to be either multifamily funds, where they're going to acquire several different multifamily apartment buildings, or what's becoming more and more popular these days are self-storage funds, which are going to buy different types of self-storage facilities. And some of them might also mix in other asset classes like mobile home parks or RV parks or boat storage or whatever. There's going to be a whole host of those things that are going on right now. And again, the benefits of the funds, as we mentioned, are primarily diversification. So three quick examples of some different funds that I'm in as far as it relates to what we've talked about with our main primary return metrics in terms of the sizzle that they might try to sell you on, right? We talked before about single asset examples. So those were all very specific apartment buildings or apartment complexes that we were talking about. Well, now with the fund example, you know, one of them, for example, will pay an 8% preferred return. They have a 20 to 22% IRR, internal rate of return projection, and a 2.16 to 2.27 equity multiple over a 3 to 5 year targeted hold. In that particular case, that fund, if we go back to sort of what we talked about at the beginning of the different types of operators that are out there, they're essentially a partially integrated operator. They're doing everything except for the property management that they outsource to a third party. So those numbers, that is what you're getting. And they, by the way, they do it the 8% pref with an 80-20 split. So you are actually getting the true 80% in terms of your limited partner portion. There's another one that is a vertically integrated, fully vertically integrated operator, and it's a fund structure. They only pay a 7% pref, preferred return. They have a 15 to 20% internal rate of return or IRR projection with a 1.7 to 2.2 equity multiple over a 4 to 6 year targeted hold. This is a company that's doing everything in-house themselves. They are a fully vertically integrated provider that just launched a fund, and that's what they're looking at. And then the other one I had on here is a fund that is much longer term in nature, and they've done several funds. These last two just started up their very first funds for the very first time, although they've been in the business doing single asset syndications for quite some time. And this is a common theme. A lot of these syndicators that were doing single asset syndications are now trying to raise money in more of a fund model because that seems to be catching on. Well, this next group, they have a little bit longer hold. So it's a 10-year targeted hold, a 5 to 8% targeted cash yield. So it's a little bit different. They don't have a preferred return necessarily, right? There's nothing that's going to accrue, but they're saying we project that we're going to pay between 5 to 8% targeted cash yield. Probably going to be closer to 5 in the beginning. And once things continue to ramp up, and once we add more assets to the fund, it's probably going to approach 8%. So that's what they're projecting. Their internal rate of return, or IRR, is only 12 to 15%, but the equity multiple is 2.2 to 2.5x equity multiple. But again, it's over 10 years. And that, if you go back to what we talked about with the different deal types, it is a combination of somewhat stabilized, so I had fully stabilized, but somewhat stabilized and some value add as far as what they're buying in that particular fund. So the cash yield is reasonable. The IRR is a little bit less. Part of the reason for that, it's a function of the timing. So if they're going to hold the money for a projected 10 years, the IRR is going to come down a little bit because you're not going to get your money back for a longer period of time. Although you are still projected to more than 2 to 2.5x multiple on the funds invested over the life of the investment. Again, it's not trying to knock it out of the park and hit a home run, but that's what they're projecting. And this particular group, again, is the one that has a 80%, 80-20 split. There is no pref, but it is essentially promoter. So they're the ones that actually go out and do the due diligence, like I mentioned earlier, and you're going to get 80% of whatever the deal is they negotiate with the individual syndicators themselves. So not the highest yielding of any of the deals or any of the funds by any means, but at the same time, I personally am fine with that and comfortable with that extra layer of oversight for a slightly lower targeted return. And they have a very, very good track record. They've done several different funds. This is their newest one. So that's something that I was fine with. So anyway, that's kind of what that looks like as far as those go. Oh, and the second one that I just mentioned that had the 7% pref, 15 to 20 IRR, and 1.7 to 2.2x multiple over 4 to 6 years, that one, I forgot to mention, has a 70-30 split on the initial returns. And they do have a waterfall. I don't have that in front of me, but I believe it goes from 70-30 until you hit 15%. And then it drops down, I believe, to 60-40 once you hit like 18%. And then it goes down to 50-50 for anything over 18%, something like that. So again, some of these, like that one, has a waterfall. Some of them do not have a waterfall. Some of them, it's one layer of fees because they're doing everything and doing all the work. Other ones, there's a second layer of fees, but they're adding value through their due diligence process and thoroughly screening and vetting certain sponsors and operators. There's no one right or wrong answer, which is why, like I've said, I personally like to diversify and get involved with multiple different funds, multiple different single assets, multiple different groups, as you could say, that I do business with. So hopefully you found this helpful. I know that's a ton of information. Again, if you have questions, feel free to email the show, realtalkpersonalfinance@gmail.com. Next time, we're going to get on here with ODog and we're going to talk about multifamily syndications, get a little bit about his backstory, his background, what he's up to, and he can share as much or as little as he wants on his metrics. I'm sure he'll be listening to this show before he comes on to the next episode. So we're looking forward to having him here. Again, feel free to share the show. And if you found that it was valuable and you feel like we've earned it, 5-star reviews and ratings are always appreciated. Thank you so much. Shout out to all the listeners. We will see you in the next episode.
Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.